Well, brethren, as we all know, the spring holy days are just around the corner. And as we also are very, very aware, this is the time of year where we typically, you know, do a self-evaluation, kind of see where we're at in our Christian lives and how we're doing, and also try to be aware of the areas that we might need improvement, you know, areas that might, you know, trip us up and become our stumbling blocks that get us off course, and, you know, we're falling into sin or just making bad decisions in our life and not following God's way. So what I'd like to do today is kind of look at this subject, hopefully, and helping us prepare for, you know, the upcoming spring holy days. Because we're going to look at this issue of stumbling blocks. Because, you know, for all of us, you know, depending upon our background, our personality, kind of how we're wired, we can all have our own individual, you know, weaknesses and stumbling blocks. You know, different areas that can trip us up and, you know, kind of either lead us into bad decisions down a wrong road, or, you know, draw us into sin, or just, you know, just making mistakes in life. Depending upon our own personalities and our own, you know, strengths and weaknesses, we all have our own unique areas depending upon who we are. But one thing that we all have in common, regardless of who we are, is we have a vulnerability to our emotions being kind of the stumbling block that gets us down the wrong road. You know, depending upon, it doesn't really matter what that emotion is, but I think we're all vulnerable that if we let our emotions start kind of running our thinking and we don't keep them in check and kind of keep our emotions under control, they can take control of our lives and really become a wedge and a tool for Satan to use to manipulate us, to get us off course and going away from God's way. So what we're going to do today is look at this particular subject. And if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's The Stumbling Block of Emotions. Again, The Stumbling Block of Emotions. Because again, I think for all of us, our emotions can be that stumbling block, maybe different particular emotions or, you know, different things that get to us, but I think that's a weakness for all of us. And Solomon points out to us in the book of Proverbs just how dangerous it can be if we don't keep our own emotions under control. You know, if we don't kind of keep a watch on them and keep them from getting us into trouble. So to start off with, let's turn over to Proverbs chapter 25. It's Proverbs chapter 25. And we're going to look at a warning here that Solomon gives us. It's chapter 25, we're going to be starting in verse 28. In Proverbs 25 and verse 28, it says, "Whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls." Now, to fully understand this particular reference, we have to kind of think back to the historical context in which Solomon was writing this. You know, because today in our modern world, you know, we typically don't build a wall around a city. You know, that's not, you know, something we're typically familiar with. But back in this particular time, you know, when they built a city somewhere, they typically built a wall around it. And that was for the protection of the city. You know, this could be for protecting the inhabitants there from wild animals, you know, that might come in and cause problems or attack people. Also from invaders, you know, from a foreign army or something wanting to come in and attack the area and steal everything everybody's got. Well, if you had a wall around the city, this served as a protection, you know, and as in a barrier to kind of defend from these things. And this is what he's talking about. And he says, well, you know, if we don't control our emotions, kind of keep a watch on them, keep them under, you know, under kind of surveillance, you might say, and keep them under control, you know, we can become like a city without walls. We're very vulnerable to attack. But because we have to remember, we have a spiritual enemy that's after us. And as the Bible tells us, he's like a roaring lion. You know, he's like a predatory animal seeking prey, looking for an easy dinner. So if we turn over to 1 Peter chapter 5, we can see where Peter talks about this. It's 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. It's very familiar scripture. It says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Now, if you've ever watched any nature shows about lions or, you know, other, you know, big predatory animals, you'll find when they hunt, they don't, you know, typically just go charge into a herd of animals, you know, that they may want to eat. They're typically looking for an opportunity. You know, they kind of stalk about. They look to find, you know, the injured animal that may be an easier kill, you know, or maybe one that's older and slower in the herd that they can easily chase down, or maybe one that's distracted and not really paying attention, you know, and they can sneak up on it, and because they're basically looking for, again, an easier opportunity to get an easy dinner. Well, Satan kind of works the same way. You know, he's strategic in how he comes after us, and he's going to look for an opportunity. Reminds me of a conversation I had with a good friend of mine several years ago. We were talking about trials in general and the tests that, you know, that we faced in life and we may face in the future. And my friend made kind of an interesting comment. You know, we were kind of talking about what, you know, what trials and tests we may face in the future. And he grins at me and he says, "I can't even tell you how it's going to come at you." And I was kind of intrigued by this statement. I said, "Well, okay, well to tell me your assessment of that." And he smiles and he looks back at me and he says, "Wherever you're most vulnerable." You know, and in other words, whatever is your weak spot where you can be gotten to, that's what Satan's going to come after. You know, because he basically would describe it, he said, Satan is an opportunist. You know, and he's going to look for an opportunity of wherever your weakness is. You know, kind of like a lion stalking, coming after a herd of animals. They're looking for the one that's injured, the one that's distracted and not paying attention. You know, something that's going to be easy to come after. Well, Satan's going to do the same thing. You know, he's going to look for that opportunity and not come at you typically as to what your strong area is that, you know, that you have a good defense and you're very aware of. You know, he's going to look for the vulnerability, you know, in the area where you're weak and he can easily trip you up. And oftentimes our emotions, again, can be that very thing. Because we have to be aware that if we allow ourselves to let our emotions kind of lead our life, you know, or to kind of maybe do our thinking for us, you know, we're very susceptible to being manipulated, you know, being manipulated by Satan or being manipulated by other individuals in our lives. You know, that's oftentimes, even if you ever dealt with like a telemarketer or someone trying to sell you something, what do they tend to do? They try to sell you with emotion because they know if they can get you to buy into something, well, because they'll tell you, well, you deserve this. You owe it to yourself. You know, you'll kick yourself if you don't get this product, you know. And they're basically selling you on the emotion because they know once you have the emotion hooked, you'll turn around and you'll reverse engineer a logic to justify that emotional decision. You know, that's just how human beings tend to be wired. And again, that's why the sales profession oftentimes trains their people that, you know, that's what you want to do. You want to find that hook, that emotional appeal and go for it. And again, once a person's locked in emotionally, the logic oftentimes, they'll justify things and push that aside to appease that emotion, even when the decision they're making is very illogical. And to look at a biblical example, I think that very, very well demonstrates this particular principle. Let's look at the life of Samson. Because what we're going to see as we go through the sermon today, we're going to look at the example of a number of biblical characters. As we're going to see, we're, you know, like in Samson's case, very strong, powerful individuals. We're going to look at individuals very wise and intelligent. And, you know, these weren't just your average, you know, run-of-the-mill person that didn't have a lot going for them. We're going to look at the examples of people that had a lot going for them. You know, they were very remarkable in a lot of ways. But what tripped them up, again, was their emotions. Let's turn over to the example here of Samson. Turn over to Judges chapter 14, and we'll look at his life here because, so as we know, you know, Samson was a guy that God blessed with a tremendous strength. You know, he was very unusual in the amount of strength that he had, and God used him as a tool to, you know, to kind of strike some blows at the Philistines. But what we can see is there is a theme throughout his life here where his emotions are played upon to get him to do illogical things, you know, and it winds up really hurting his life. I mean, actually becoming absolutely devastating to the consequences of his life and how he's played upon. He makes some decisions that, you know, particularly as we're going to see here in the second case, where it was blatantly obvious what was going to happen to him, you know, if he goes down this road. But because he's thinking with his emotions, he doesn't see the logic of what's happening to him. So let's start off here in Judges chapter 14 in verse 5. And we'll see a story here where, you know, Samson marries a Philistine woman. But notice how his emotions are played on here, and it winds up he's being betrayed. It's in Judges chapter 14 in verse 5. So Samson went down to Timnah, and his father and mother, and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him. And the Spirit of Jehovah he came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat. Though he had nothing in his hand, but he did not tell his father or mother what he had done. And then he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. And after some time, when he returned to get her, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. And he took some of it on his hands and went along, eating. And when he came to his father and mother, he gave them some, and they ate also. But he did not tell them what he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. So his father went down to the woman, and Samson gave a feast there for the young men used to do so. And it was so that when they saw him, they brought him 30 companions, to be with him. And then Samson said to them, "Let me pose a riddle to you. If you can correctly solve and explain it to me within the 7 days of the feast, then I will give you 30 garments and 30 changes of clothing. But if not, if you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing." And they said to him, "Pose your riddle that we may hear it." So he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet." Now for 3 days they could not explain the riddle. So it came to pass on the seventh day that he had said to Samson's wife, "And entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you in your father's house with fire. And have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so?" Then Samson's wife wept on him and said, "You only hate me, you do not love me. And you have posed a riddle on the sons of my people, but you have not explained it to me." And he said to her, "Look, I have not explained it to my mother, to my father or my mother, so should I explain it to you?" Now notice the appeal that what she's done to him. She's not just asking him the question. She's played the card, "If you really loved me, you would do what I want. And you would give me this information." And then she's crying and she's playing upon his emotions, because again, this is meant to make him feel bad. Like he's an insensitive, horrible husband, and he doesn't care about her and he doesn't love her because he won't tell her this information. But these aren't sincere tears that she's crying. She's got an agenda, because we already know, she's purposely looking to get this information so she can betray him. So again, this isn't real trauma, that she's expressing with her tears. She's just blatantly trying to manipulate him. And this is a ploy, as we'll talk about here in a minute, can oftentimes be a weakness for men. And then a woman's tears oftentimes will really kind of punch their buttons, and they can abandon logic, and can try to go along to appease the emotions, not looking at the bigger picture of what's taking place here. But let's just pick up the story and follow it. Verse 17. Now she had wept on him the 7 days while their feast lasted. And notice she's working on him, and this has been going on for 7 days. So now he's going to start feeling guilty. Like he's not a sensitive, nice guy, and he doesn't love her because, he's been playing on his emotions now for a week. And it happened on the seventh day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. And then he explained the riddle to the sons of her people. So the men in the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, "Well, what is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion?" And he said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved the riddle." So notice here what happens is she plays upon his emotions and gets him to share this information. But again, she wasn't crying these tears because she sincerely felt unloved. It was just a way to be manipulative and to play upon his emotions to get him to give this information. And as we'll see here, later when we look at the example of Delilah, this becomes a trend in Samson's life. Obviously, this was a weakness for him that could be played upon, but because think about what's going to happen here. Now, again, in this example, we don't have reason to, necessarily know that Samson could see this coming. Now, we're going to see later in the example of Delilah, it was painfully obvious what she's up to, because the track record of behavior, would make this just any common person with common sense could see what was going to happen. But how does Samson get tripped up here? It's because she's playing on his emotions. He's not thinking logically at this point. He's trying to appease emotions. He's trying to, get her to stop crying, and feel like he's a good guy, that he's made her feel good. And quite frankly, he's probably trying to absolve his own guilt. But because if you think about it, she's crying, and this is going on for a week. "You don't love me. You don't care about me. You're an insensitive, uncaring husband. You don't show your love." Well, now he's wanting to prove he's a nice guy. You know, he's not this horrible bad husband. You know, he's a nice guy that cares about her. And so he's wanting to give her this information. He's thinking with his emotions. You know, and again, there's a greater lesson we can learn in all of this. And again, not only just the general lesson of this, but as I mentioned before, I said, oftentimes for a lot of men in particular, a woman's tears can be a situation that they just don't have a defense for. They easily fall for it. You know, and understand, I'm not suggesting at all that, you know, husbands should just be insensitive jerks and never care about if they've hurt their wife. And that's not what I'm saying at all. But I'm sometimes with if you look at track records of behavior and logic, you can sometimes sort out, is this real trauma and pain that's happening here, or is this an attempt at manipulation? And let me give you kind of a personal example of something I experienced. This is a number of years ago. I was doing a counseling session with a lady I'd known for a little while at this point. Again, this was a number of years ago. But knowing this individual, I knew that she had, you know, kind of a track record, you might say, of being a bit dramatic about things in her life. She also tended to look at the world kind of conceptualizing herself, you might say, as a victim, you know, where she would see, you know, the troubles and the problems in her life from her point of view. Well, the reason she's having troubles in her life, that was all everybody else's fault. You know, that was all the other people in her life. They were the source of the problem, and it wasn't any of her own decisions and you know, and her own behavior that created the difficulties. And I was having kind of a counseling session with her one day, and you know, we were kind of talking about these kind of things, and it was kind of clear to me that, you know, some of the subject matter we were talking about, that her own decisions, her own behavior had created a lot of, you know, her own troubles. You know, and I was trying to gently kind of point this out to her. You know, of you know, okay, now let's look how you behaved here and what you did there, and didn't that kind of result in this? And you know, and isn't part of the problem here looking at yourself? Well, kind of out of nowhere, all of a sudden, she immediately just gets burst into tears and starts kind of characterizing herself as, you know, this wounded victim. I mean, and she literally kind of bends her head down, you know, in tears like this, and she's got a hand over her face. Well, I'd seen this kind of thing a time or two before with this individual, so I kind of knew, you know, this isn't real trauma. This is a distraction to get away from having to talk about, you know, some of her own failings. But what struck me, and quite frankly was a little humorous and amusing to me, what was, as she's doing this, I know she was expecting me to immediately jump into consoling mode, you know, change the subject, not talk about any of her behavior, and treat her as the victim and want to stop the tears. And I just kind of patiently sat there, didn't say anything. I was kind of waiting for this to run its course, so we could get back to, you know, discussing things. And literally, as she has her head over like this, you know, and she's kind of waiting for me to jump into console, and I don't do that, she literally does this, and she peeks her eyes open and she looks through her fingers, and I can tell what she's doing is looking to see, is he falling for it. You know, and she looked at me, and I'm not jumping in to console. I'm just kind of sitting there patiently waiting, you know, kind of waiting for this to play its course. And what was funny is when she sees that, she drops her hand down, her head comes up, the tears stop just as fast as they turned on. I mean, it was like a light switch when they came on and when they came off. And she starts having a logical conversation with me as if it never happened, you know, which confirmed for me this isn't real trauma that we're dealing with here. This was just a way to distract, to change the subject, to get away from having to face, you know, her own actions. You know, and again, please understand, I'm not suggesting every husband out there should just be insensitive jerks and never care if your wife is crying. That's not where I'm going with this. But what I'm saying, if you stopped and look at this logically, and again, looking at a track record of behavior, and we'll talk about this in a moment, because, you know, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And because I knew there was a track record for some of this, I could see what was happening, you know, and realize this was an emotional ploy. But again, if we can be aware of these types of things that can be our triggers, we can keep from being sometimes drawn into bad decisions, you know, that we get into to appease emotions, not looking at the greater situation. Because this was a lesson that Samson had to learn very much the hard way, with very devastating conclusions. You know, because we won't cover this part of the story, but later, you know, the wife that's described here, she later winds up getting killed, you know, and you'll see if you read through the book of Judges. And then later, he winds up meeting Delilah, you know, and falls in love with her. So let's jump later to the story with her. Let's turn over to Judges chapter 16 and verse 4. Now, we're going to see here with Delilah, you know, she wants to find out the source of Samson's strength. you know, and she keeps, you know, asking for this information. But as we're going to see here, she plays the same card on him that the first wife plays. If you really loved me, you would tell me what I wanted to know. But in her case, it's much more obvious, because by the time Samson gives her the true information, he's had enough behavior to witness that there is a pattern here, and it's very predictable what she's going to do next. But let's pick up here in Judges 16 and verse 4. Now afterward it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came to her and said to her, entice him and find out where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him, and every one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So now notice again, he's being bribed. You know, this lady is being bribed to betray him. This is kind of a repeat of the same movie. You know, this is what the first wife did to him. You know, where now it's an evil agenda, and she's playing upon his emotions, you know, to get him to reveal information. In verse 6. So Delilah said to Samson, please tell me where your great strength lies, and with what you may be bound to afflict you. And Samson said to her, if they bind me with 7 fresh bow sticks, and not yet dry, and I shall become weak like any other man. So the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings, yet not dried, and she bound him with them. Now there were men lying in wait, staying with her in the room. And she said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he broke the bowstrings as a strand of yarn breaks when it touches fire. So the secret of his strength was not known. Then Delilah said to him, look, you have mocked me and told me lies. Now please tell me what you may be bound with. So he said to her, if you bind me securely with new ropes that have never been used, and I shall become weak like any other man. Therefore Delilah took new robes, but bound him with them, and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. And then there were men lying in wait, staying in the room. But he broke them with his arms like a threat. And then Delilah said to Samson, until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me what you may be bound with. And he said to her, if you weave the 7 locks of my head into a web of a loom. So she wove it tightly in the pattern of a loom and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he awoke from his sleep, pulled out the batten of the web from the loom. Then she said to him, how can you say to me, I love you, when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these 3 times, and you have not told me where your strength lies. Now notice again the card she's playing. If you really loved me, you would tell me what I want to know. But again, at this point, a very common sense principle should be coming out to Samson. As I love to put it, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. There's a track record here. 3 times now, you know, she's asking for the source of his strength. What does she immediately do with that information? Every single time, she immediately tries to throw him under the bus, you know, and betray him to the Philistines. There's kind of a pattern emerging here. You know, if Samson had just looked at this logically and said, okay, there's a track record here, project forward. I know how this movie's going to end. You know, it's pretty easy and pretty common sense to project what's going to happen next. You know, this isn't rocket science. You know, anyone with common sense could look at this and go, well, I kind of know how this movie is going to end here. You know, if he gives her the good information, you know, of how it really works, he's going to get betrayed and this is going to end very badly. But see, what happens here is Samson's emotions get played upon. He doesn't sit back and look at this logically and analytically and go, okay, wait a minute. There's a track record of behavior here, and I'm being manipulated, so the last thing I want to do is play into this. No, she starts playing on his emotions. He's probably feeling guilty here because, oh, you're an insensitive husband. You've mocked me. You don't love me. If you loved me, you would do what I want. You know, and what happens at this point is, again, he's no longer thinking, you know, logically and analytically with the situation. He's trying to appease emotions. You know, he wants to make her feel better and make her stop, you know, nagging at him and constantly telling him he's a bad guy. And he wants to appease his own guilt. you know, and feel good about himself, because, you know, he doesn't want to think I'm an insensitive jerk husband who doesn't love my wife. And now he's on a mission to prove he's a good guy and he really cares about her. And boy, does this movie end badly. You know, so let's pick up here. Start again in verse 15. Then she said to him, "How can you say I love you? See, you don't really love me. And when your heart is not with me, you have mocked me these three times, and you have not told me where your great strength lies." And it came to pass when she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him, so that his soul was vexed to death. Notice he's getting worn out now. Now his emotions are getting worn down, and he just wants this to stop. You know, and he wants to stop feeling guilty about himself, you know, and just appease her emotions and get her to stop bothering him. In verse 17, he told her all his heart and said to her, "No razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb, and I am shaven with strength, and will leave, my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak like any other man." And when Delilah saw that he had told her all of his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up once more, for he has told me all his heart." So the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hand. Then she lulled him to sleep on her knees, called for a man, and had him shave all the seven locks of his head. And then she began to torment him with his strength left him. And she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." So he awoke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as before, as other times, and shake myself free." But he did not know that Jehovah had departed from him. And then the Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza. And they bound him with bronze feathers, and he became a grinder in the prison. Notice this ended very badly, you know. And it's not like he couldn't see it coming. You know, this is something where, again, if he just utilized a very basic common sense principle, best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. It's very easy to predict how this movie was going to end. I mean, three times he gives her an answer. Every time he does, you know, she promptly uses that to try to betray him. It's not rocket science to go, okay, if we give her the right answer, well, we know how that's going to end. You know, but what happens here is he ignores this common sense, you know, conclusion, and basically throws himself under the bus, you know, because by giving her this information, it was no surprise this was going to end badly, and the consequences were devastating. You know, he gets his eyes torn, you know, poked out, he becomes a slave, his life is ruined, you know, going forward, all because of a bad decision. Well, there's a proverb that Solomon gives us that very much kind of illustrates this principle. It's in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 3. And again, Proverbs 22 and verse 3. Now, I normally read out of the New King James translation, but I'm going to read this one to you out of the NIV because I kind of like the way it words it better. It says, "A prudent man sees danger and takes refuge, but the simple keep going and suffer for it." See, this is a situation that Samson could have very easily foreseen what was going to happen next. You know, it wasn't rocket science to look at this and go, okay, she's got a very clear track record. She does the same thing every time, you know, she gets this information. Not real hard to project forward what she's going to do if she gets the right information. You know, but instead of being the prudent, seeing the danger coming and acting accordingly, he's the simple. He keeps, you know, charging forward, basically thinking, oh, it'll be different this time. You know, if I just, you know, I'm just positive about it and give her this, well, it'll be okay. No, it wasn't okay. You know, it ended very badly. You know, and this is a principle, again, if we utilize in our lives, we can save ourselves a lot of trouble. You know, again, just to give you some simple examples of this, I've worked as a recruiter for the last 20 years. You know, so basically a lot of my job is, you know, interviewing people, trying to make placements within the company, you know, that I work for. But you learn quickly as a recruiter. You know, when you're dealing with people, you know, it's a job that where you're constantly being pulled in multiple directions all the time. And you have to kind of prioritize, you know, what you're going to focus your time and your energy on. And you learn quickly that there is a lot of activities and things that you can be doing that you can burn up a lot of time on that doesn't necessarily get you any benefit, you know, because what you're hired to do is, again, to fill the openings of your company, You know, and what you want to bring about is, again, filling these positions and not only just making a hire, but hopefully making a hire that's going to last for a while. It's kind of good for all parties concerned, you know, where the candidate's going to get a job and a job that they're happy with, that they're going to want to stay in, and the department gets an employee and, again, someone who works well with their team, and everybody wins, you know. But you learn it, again, trying to manage your time in all of this. Literally from the time I pick up a resume or deal with an individual, I'm trying to look down the road and see where's this movie going to end? You know, because if you start kind of thinking like that and looking for obvious roadblocks that can come down the road through this process, you learn once you see this, you try to be the prudent, you know, and you take action to not waste your time going down this road if you know it's going to end badly. You know, if you're going to kind of foresee some roadblocks going to come up here, whether it be compensation, whether it be the needs of the department, whether this person's really going to stay in this position, whether this really works for their long-term goals, you know, and you're always trying to think like this. And again, even when you're interviewing someone, you're always kind of look at what's their past decisions, not just the words that they tell you, because, you know, if you're in a job like this, I mean, think about it. If you've ever gone to a job interview, what are you doing when you're being interviewed? Well, you're trying to tell back to the interviewer what you think they want to hear because you want to get the job, you know. So you're basically already kind of giving a false impression of yourself, you know. Well, what you learn to do is look at people's behavior, not just their words, you know, and try to see what's going to, you know, where this is going to lead, you know. And a lot of times, you know, and I try to do this with candidates and with hiring managers, is when you can kind of see this isn't going to end well, you try to be very upfront with them. You know, and kind of say, okay, let me tell you how this movie is going to end. It's not going to end the way you want it, you know, to work out. Now, what I found in doing this for 20 years is a lot of people are very thankful for that. Like, I appreciate you being upfront with me and being very straight with me up front, so they don't waste their time pursuing that something that's not going to work. But you always deal with the people that go, oh, well, I'm just so positive. You know, I just want to be positive about this and pursue this anyway. You know, and time after time, I've seen situations where you kind of tell them, okay, it's not going to work out the way you want to, and they just won't see that, you know, and they insist going forward, and then they're very frustrated and upset later when they wasted a lot of their time, and it didn't turn out the way they wanted it to go, and again, if you start kind of looking at this in terms of how, if I do this move, where does this end, and where is this going to go? And one of the keys is looking at, again, the track record of behavior with individuals. Because if you learn to kind of to spot that, you can stop yourself from dealing with a lot of frustration in life. In fact, even sometimes in broad general senses, you can look at individuals' behavior if there are strong patterns and project forward sometimes a year or two in advance and go, okay, if, you know, circumstances keep going in this direction, you know, at some point this is X is going to happen. You know, and you can literally sometimes see the trouble coming a year or two in advance, you know, and take action to kind of get around it, you know. But what often happens sometimes is, you know, people, even in pattern behaviors, just take a stereotypical example of someone who's in an abusive relationship, you know. So say they've got a spouse or a family member that maybe has an addiction problem. You know, they have a problem with alcohol or drugs or whatever, and this is an ongoing issue that causes chaos in their life. But periodically they become violent, you know, and, you know, they smack around other people in their life. Well, oftentimes what will happen is you'll see a cycle in this, you know, and people will kind of go down this road and then they get violent. And then when bad consequences are about to come from them, well, now, oh, they're going to change. They're never going to do it again, you know. But then the cycle repeats, and it repeats, and this goes on for years. But you'll oftentimes see people who are kind of stuck in these environments think, well, he's promised he's never going to do that again. You know, if I'm just positive that'll happen, you stop. Wait a minute, isn't this the same thing that's happened numerous times in a row? You know, and what'll happen is oftentimes people get into wishful thinking and they don't stop and go, okay, if you look at the pattern of behavior, there's no real change that's taking place here. You know, and another phrase you'll oftentimes hear when people are kind of stuck into this, particularly if they have a religious background or, you know, they're Christians and such, you'll hear the phrase, well, I'm just positive because, you know, God can change anybody. God can change anybody. I'm just, you know, optimistic. I have faith. God can change anybody. Well, let's realize, actually, the way they make that statement, that's actually not true. And let me show you an example here. Turn over to Matthew chapter 3. It's Matthew chapter 3. We're going to look at an example here of John the Baptist. It's a situation where, you know, John is, you know, in his ministry baptizing people, and he has some of the Pharisees come to him for, you know, requesting baptism. Now, we'll look in Matthew chapter 3 and verse 4. And John himself was clothed in camel hair and with a leather belt around his waist. And his food was locusts and wild honey. And then Jerusalem, all Judea, and all the region of the Jordan went out to him, where he baptized, and were baptized by him in the Jordan for, in confessing their sins. But when he saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming to him, he said to them, "Brood of vipers, who has warned you to come to flee from the wrath to come? Therefore bear fruits worthy of repentance. And do not think and say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham as our father.' For I say to you that God is able to raise up children to Abraham from these stones." You know, even in Acts, laid to the root of the trees, "Therefore every tree which does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire." Now, let me explain what I mean here. I mentioned the comment here when people say, "Well, God can change anybody," and I said, that's actually not true. Now, realize I'm not saying that God's power is limited and he can't, you know, fix anyone who is, you know, depending upon him and yielding to his spirit to do so. What I mean by that is God requires willing participants. You know, and just like what John was saying with them, you know, when these Pharisees come for baptism, you know, I mean, all you have to do is read Matthew chapter 23 and Christ's critique of the Pharisees to realize these guys had a pretty nasty track record. You know, if you looked at their past behavior, it was not a good picture. You know, and it wasn't a situation where God's not willing to work with, you know, and try to rehabilitate these guys too. It was an issue of showing that there's real change here. You know, because John didn't just baptize them and say, you know, "Well, hey, I'm positive, you know, and if we baptize them and we're positive about it, maybe they'll repent later, you know, because God can change everybody." You know, that's not what he did. You know, John looks at it and says, okay, first go shine, you know, show fruits worthy of repentance. In other words, demonstrate with your behavior, you know, that you're actually making a meaningful change. You know, and when you do that, then we'll talk. You know, because it's not an issue that people can't change. Because sometimes when I say this, you know, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, people go, "Well, you're not allowing for people to change. You know, you're not saying that, you know, that people have had a bad past can change." No, they absolutely can change. But the evidence of that, again, is a change in their behavior. It's not just the words. You know, because oftentimes, again, people will play upon emotions, you know, and try to make you feel bad, but there's no real evidence of change of behavior. And the key here is, again, looking at change of behavior, because that's the real indicator. Because, again, people can definitely change. That's the entire point of again, being baptized and repenting. But that's, again, showing real repentance, and there's a change in life. But again, the kind of the point I'm getting at here is realizing how our emotions can be played upon. And we can make bad decisions going forward if we're trying to appease emotion. You know, or again, rather than sometimes just taking a logical step back, you know, to look at what's happening in the situation here. They can look at ourselves, they can look at the track record of other people's behavior, you know, and realize what's taking place, because we make much better decisions that way. But again, to kind of follow the example here, when I'm talking about how our emotions can be manipulated. As I mentioned before, we're going to look at a number of very talented individuals, you know, in the Bible. They weren't foolish individuals, they were wise, you know, talented, strong individuals whose emotions wound up doing them in. In fact, we're going to see here, this actually happened to the wisest man who's ever lived. Let's turn over and look at the example of Solomon. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 3. So 1 Kings chapter 3. And we'll see here at the beginning of Solomon's reign, you know, God asks him basically, what gift would you like to receive? And Solomon asks for wisdom, and he's blessed with being, you know, the wisest man who ever lived. So start in 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 5. And at Gibeon, Jehovah appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, "Ask what I shall give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth and righteousness and in uprightness of heart with you. And you have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on the throne as it is to this day. Now, O Jehovah, my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child, and I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? And the speech pleased Jehovah, and Solomon had asked for this thing. And then God said to him, because you have asked this thing, and you have not asked for long life for yourself, you have not asked for riches for yourself, and you have asked for the life of your enemies, but you have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there may not be anyone like you before you, nor shall there be any arise after you. And I've also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so you shall not be anyone like you among all the kings in your days. So if you walk in my ways and keep my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, I will strengthen your days. So see, Solomon, you know, is gifted, as it says here, being the wisest man before his time and even after. I mean, he was known famously for it. You know, not only as he wrote, you know, major sections of the Bible, you know, sharing this wisdom, but even in his time, I mean, people would come far and wide to, you know, to talk to him and to get advice from him because he was so known for his wisdom. In spite of all of this, it's his emotions and his inability to, you know, to keep them under check that ruins his life and destroys all of this. So if you just turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, look and see, he basically kind of cast, you know, self-control aside. You know, not realizing that his own emotions, his own desires, you know, that he could be his own worst enemy, you know, in spite of the great wisdom that he had, you know, he kind of ignores all of this and decides, you know, he's going to indulge any desire that he has. You know, well, obviously, if you take that approach, you're going to try to satisfy every emotion, every whim, every desire that you have, and this is basically what he did. And you turn over to Ecclesiastes 2 and start in verse 1. And I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, but surely this was also vanity. I sought laughter, and it was madness, and what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, and with guiding my heart with wisdom, how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good under the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. And I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. And I made myself water pools in which to water the growing trees of the grove. And I acquired male and female servants, and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks, and all were in Jerusalem before me. And I also gathered for myself silver and gold, the special treasures of kings and other provinces. And I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and the musical instruments of all kind. So I became great and excelled more than all that were before me in Jerusalem, and my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them, and I did not hold from my heart, you know, from any pleasure. For my heart rejoiced in all the labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works in which my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping in the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Now notice what he did here is he basically cast aside self-control. You know, well, all of us, one of the lessons we have to learn in life is, you know, trying to satisfy all of our desires and following every emotional impulse we have is a really bad idea. You know, that's something to really get us in trouble in a heartbeat. You know, and this is really what happened to Solomon. You know, in spite of all of his wisdom and what he had to be aware of, you know, the chief thing that got him in trouble was really, you might say, his emotions and his hormones. I mean, you know, his desire for love, you know, and such with lots and lots of wives, you know, really was just his undoing. You know, and the Bible directly tells us that this was the case. You know, turn over to 1 Kings chapter 11. It's 1 Kings chapter 11. We're going to start in verse 1. So 1 Kings chapter 11 in verse 1. But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, the Amorites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, and the Hittites. And for the nations of whom Jehovah had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. For surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. And Solomon clung to these in love. See, he clearly would know better. Moses' writings clearly laid out, you know, this is not something you should do. And he had to be aware of this. I mean, this is the wisest man who ever lived. And in spite of that, he still throws caution to the wind. In verse 3, and he had 700 wives and princes and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. You know, it's always puzzled me, given the magnitude of the numbers here, how he got the numbers quite so high without learning, you know, long before he gets to this point, that this is not turning out very well. You know, but pick up in verse 4, for it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to Jehovah his God, and nor was his heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of Jehovah, and did not fully follow Jehovah as did his father David. Then Solomon built a high place in Chemosh in the abomination of Moab, and on the hill that is the east of Jerusalem for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon, and did likewise for all the foreign wives and who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So Jehovah became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from Jehovah, God of Israel, and who had appeared to him twice. And he had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods, but he did not keep what Jehovah had commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this, and have not kept my covenant and my statutes which I commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear out the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom, but I will give one tribe to you, you know, for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Now notice here, his undoing was again his desire for love, you know, and honestly, probably his hormones as well here. But you can imagine how the scenario played out here. I would imagine, you know, the first wife that played upon him, well, if you really love me, you know, you'd build an altar to my God, you know, and you'd be involved in, you know, in the worship and what's important to me. Well, once he does it for the first one, then the others, well, if you loved me as much as you loved her, you know, you would do this. And now he's got himself in a real pickle, you know, and he does one after the other, and this just sucks him in. And see, oftentimes this can be the undoing of lots of us. I mean, if you think in just in terms of emotions, I mean, even just the emotion of loneliness, you know, can wind up being a stumbling block. Because oftentimes that's what happens with single people in the church, you know, is in marrying someone totally of a different faith who's not going to be supportive of, you know, the life that they want to live as a Christian. Sometimes the emotion that trips them up is just the emotion of loneliness. You know, and what really, you know, knocks them astray with this. And because again, our emotions can really be that stumbling block, because it creates the opportunity, you know, for Satan to play on whatever that emotion is and start leading us down the road where we're trying to appease that emotion, you know, and then we're not trying to make logical decisions. You know, and another one of the emotions that can happen here, and I'm sure this also played out in Solomon's, you know, situation with all the wives that he has, is the emotion of jealousy. And just to first of all kind of see a biblical principle on this, turn over to James chapter 3. It's James chapter 3, and we'll start in verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing will be there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure and peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And now the fruit of righteousness is sown in the peace of those who make peace. And notice here it talks about how envy and jealousy results in confusion. You get confusion and chaos of what can happen here. And again, I'm sure that happened in Solomon's situation. Imagine with all of these wives and all the different children and just the sheer numbers of what he's dealing with. You know, he's got to have, you know, lots of wives who just feel neglected and hurt, and they never get any attention, and they're vying to, you know, to try to get that love and then try to get favoritism for their children, because, I mean, 1,000 wives has got to be an enormous number of children here. You know, and Solomon's one guy, he can't be stretched in this many directions. It's just a setup for disaster, you know, is what he set himself up for. But imagine the chaos that all the jealousy can cause here. And just to get a clear example of this, turn over to Genesis chapter 29. We'll see a situation that played out here with Jacob and his wives. Because, you know, Jacob winds up making a deal with Laban, you know, to marry Rachel. And then he gets tricked into marrying Leah. But then, you know, he accepts that marriage and then wants to, you know, marry Rachel as well. Well, the situation that plays out, you can see how much confusion and chaos gets created because of the jealousy that's taking place here. Starting in Genesis 29 and verse 31. Then Yahweh saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So Leah conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Reuben, for he said, Yahweh has surely looked upon my affliction. Now therefore my husband will love me. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, because Yahweh has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son, and he called his name Simeon. And she deceived again and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will come attached to me, because I have borne him three sons. Therefore his name was called Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, now I will praise Yahweh. Therefore called his name Judah, and then she stopped bearing. Now we're going to continue on with the story, but what I want you to notice here as we go through this is how the actions of Leah and Rachel are motivated by getting their husband's love. You know, getting the attention, getting the love and adoration that they're seeking, but their children and even the handmaidens basically become pawns in a game. They're basically objects to be used, trying to fulfill these unmet emotional needs, you know, and it just creates chaos within the family. And notice, keep reading here, beginning of chapter 30. Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, give me children, else I die. Now, again, notice this is envy and trying to meet her emotional needs. Then Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel, and he said, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of your womb? So she said, here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her that she will bear a child on my knees, and I will also may have children by her. Now notice that Bilhah is just an object to be used now to fulfill her emotional desires. The children that are going to result in the handmaiden have now become objects to be used to satisfy emotions. In verse 4, and then she gave him Bilhah, her maid, his wife, and Jacob went into her, and Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. And Rachel said, God has judged my case, and he has also heard my voice and given me a son. Therefore he called his name Dan. And Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. And then Rachel said, with great wrestlings, I have wrestled with my sister, and indeed I have prevailed. Now notice this is a competition with her sister, and everybody else is an object to be used. And so she called his name Naphtali. And when Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took Zilpah, her maid, and gave her to Jacob, his wife. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. And Leah said, a troop comes, and she has called his name Gath. And Leah made Zilpah bore a Jacob a second son. And Leah said, I am happy, for the daughters will call me blessed. So she has called his name Asher. Now notice the focus is totally on herself. Everybody else is an object to be used. Now Reuben went into the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. And then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, therefore, he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. Now, they're basically making deals back and forth now on Jacob's time. You know, and when Jacob came out of the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you for my son's mandrakes. You know, he's being bought and sold now. And he may with her, and he lay with her that night. And God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. And God has given me my hire, because I have given my maid to my husband. So she has called his name Issachar. And Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me, because I have borne him six sons. Notice the children are objects for her to get the love and attention she wants. So she has called his name Zebulun. Afterwards, she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. And then God remembered Rachel, and God had listened to her and opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And called his name Joseph and said, Jehovah shall add me to another son. Now notice what's happening here and how much chaos is taking place here. And this is all being sparked by the emotion of envy. Basically, they're both desiring love and, you know, their husband to take care of them and show them attention and such. And literally the children and the handmaids become objects to be used. You know, it just becomes chaos. And how did all this start? The inability to deal with the emotions they were feeling, feeling hurt and neglected, and, you know, envying the attention the other one was getting. And now it just becomes a game back and forth. You know, if you think about it, another example where this kind of thing can play out is, unfortunately, oftentimes children that are in a divorce, you know, because oftentimes what can happen, and I mean, I was a child myself, my parents divorced when I was 8 years old, and I kind of experienced this, you know, where it isn't so much necessarily vying for love and attention, sometimes the children become objects to hurt the other spouse. You know, whereas they basically use the kids as a way to kind of express their anger, you know, towards the, you know, the other spouse, you know, either, you know, during or after a divorce, and the children get caught in the middle of this, and they basically become pawns in a game. You know, so again, it's one of those things we have to be aware of our own feelings, and again, not just look at what we're feeling at the moment, but again, ask that question, if I go down this road, how does this movie end? And how does this affect, you know, other people? What's the long-term effects of this? Because if we stop and look at a logical, analytical picture of things, sometimes we can separate from that emotion and, again, look at the bigger picture. You know, because oftentimes when we make bad decisions, it's, again, being sucked into that emotion we're feeling at the moment and appeasing that emotion and not looking at, okay, if we go down this path, is there danger ahead? You know, does it hurt me? Does it hurt the innocent bystanders and others who are involved? Because if we get locked into the emotion, sometimes we can get totally skewed on the bigger picture. Well, another common emotion that can really trip us up, I think we're all kind of aware this can be a dangerous emotion, is the emotion of anger. Now, let me give you a definition I like to use for how to define anger. Because sometimes, you know, you can give that a number of different definitions of exactly what that means. But I like to define anger as an emotional response to a real or perceived injustice. Because oftentimes, think about it, when we get upset or angry about something, oftentimes the core of it is we feel we've been done wrong or someone that we care about has been done wrong. You know, and that can be a real injustice, that can be just a perceived injustice. You know, either way, we respond the same way when we feel like we've been done wrong. And as we're going to see in some of the examples we look at here, that oftentimes it doesn't matter whether that injustice was real or not, we still have to effectively manage it. because we can be very angry over a very real injustice, you know, and a very legitimate injustice, and they can still destroy our lives. So let's, first of all, turn over to Ephesians chapter 4. We'll look at a warning here the Bible gives us about anger. And again, one of the reasons I like to define it is an emotional response to an injustice. As we're going to see here, it's not necessarily automatically wrong that we're angry about something. It's how we manage it. Because Ephesians 4 and verse 26, "Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down upon your wrath, nor give place to the devil." Because, you know, it's not saying that don't ever get angry about anything, because anger is inherently wrong. No, it can be a just, you know, reason to be angry. But it warns you here, you know, be real careful with this, you know, because this can quickly become an opportunity for Satan to take advantage of this and lead you down a very wrong path. But because, see, anger can be like cancer. You know, if you ever dealt with someone with cancer, you know, cancer can start in one part of the body. And then if it metastasizes, it can spread all throughout the body and affect everything about your body. Well, anger can work the same way. Now, turn over to Proverbs chapter 29. Proverbs 29 and verse 22. "An angry man stirs up strife, and a furious man abounds in transgression." Now, notice it says he abounds in transgression. Well, that's because anger, you know, if we really let anger get control of our lives, it becomes a cancer. You know, we abound in transgression because it starts spilling over into all the other areas of our life, you know, and starts really polluting our thinking and leading us down a wrong path. You know, in fact, I mean, it's not just like a cancer. It can be like an infectious disease, you know. And in other words, it can not only just ruin our lives, it can negatively affect those who are around us and in those ways, because it can rub off on other people. And to see that, turn over to Proverbs 22. Proverbs 22, we'll start in verse 24. "Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul." In other words, it's kind of like an infectious disease. You know, we hang around someone who's angry and resentful, you know, and it kind of just comes out in their life and how they talk about things and how they live their life. Well, that attitude can rub off on us, you know, and we can start kind of taking on their attitude and develop that in our own lives, and it becomes a snare. You know, it becomes an opportunity again for Satan to take advantage of and then to manipulate us. Because again, one of the keys here is, again, looking at this as, you know, again, as I mentioned, a real or perceived injustice. But because oftentimes, you know, that's what gets us angry and gets us worked up and resentful about something in life is I've been done wrong. You know, and again, that can be real or perceived. It can be legitimately we were done wrong, or we just see it that way. You know, because sometimes in life we weren't necessarily done wrong like we think, you know, but we see it that way, you know, and we'll respond accordingly. Well, I think it's very important to realize sometimes it doesn't always matter whether it was legitimate or not. Because let's look at an example of a man who destroyed his own life over his inability to deal with anger, even though the issues he could be upset about here were very legitimate. We're going to look at the example of Ahithophel. Now, Ahithophel was a very wise man. In fact, he was known for his wise counsel. It's even said of him in the Bible, as we'll read through here today, that, you know, inquiring as Ahithophel was if he'd gotten advice from God himself. You know, it's like that this guy was just known for his great wisdom. But as you're going to see here, he's a counselor to King David. And there's a point where he gets very angry with David, and he's literally on a mission to kill David. Now, the Bible doesn't come right out and spell out for us what exactly his issues are and why he feels so negatively about David. But if we put together his family tree and then look at his advice, you know, that he gives when he's against David, I think it's not hard to figure out what he's upset about. You know, so let's turn over to 2 Samuel 23. Let's just kind of quickly look at, let's say, his family tree here, who he's related to. And I think we can easily see a reason why he would have a beef against David. In 2 Samuel 23, now we're going to break into a context and look just at verse 34. This is a list of David's mighty men here, but we don't really, you know, it's not relevant to us, all this whole list. I just want you to notice here where Ahithophel is mentioned. This is verse 34. In Eliphelet, the son of Ashbi, the son of Maacathite, Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. Now, all I want you to notice from this is that Eliam's father is Ahithophel. You know, Eliam is his son. Now, let's notice who's related to Eliam. Turn over to chapter 11, 2 Samuel chapter 11. And look at verse 1. Now it came to pass in the spring of the year, at the time when the kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and then besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. And then it happened one evening that David arose in his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Now, if you look at this story, you know, Eliam is, you know, Bathsheba's father. Ahithophel is Eliam's father. Ahithophel is Bathsheba's grandfather. Now, as you know, the story with David and Bathsheba, you know, he winds up having an affair with her. You know, she winds up getting pregnant. And this child winds up dying as a result of this sin. But David goes farther than this. David, you know, realizes that he's about to get caught here because, you know, her husband, Uriah, has been out in the battlefield fighting in the army. Everybody's going, no, it can't be Uriah's kid. You know, there had to be some foul play here. You know, so David sets up Uriah and has him murdered, you know, to basically make his guilt go away and to try to cover this up. Where you can easily see why Ahithophel would have a problem with David. I mean, just think of the issues he can accuse David of. You know, this guy destroyed my grandmother's life, I mean, my granddaughter's life. He's responsible for the death of my great-grandchild. He betrayed his own troops and, you know, set up one of his own people and had him murdered. I mean, he can make some severe allegations against David, and it's all true. He's not making any of this up. It's not, he doesn't have to blow a situation out of proportion. He can say David's guilty of all of this, and it's absolutely true. You know, well, what happens here is Ahithophel joins a rebellion against David. You know, David's son Absalom is basically dividing the nation, you know, and there's kind of an attempted coup going on here. And Ahithophel basically joins up with Absalom. But you can see here the advice he's giving, he's trying to get even with David. So let's turn over to 2 Samuel 16, start in verse 20. And then Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give counsel as to what I should do." And Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Go into your father's concubines who he has left to keep his house. And all Israel will hear that you have abhorred your father, and in the hands of all who are strong will be who are with you will be strong." And notice he's basically saying, go have go take your father's wives, you know, because a concubine at that time is not just a girlfriend, that's a wife of lesser status, is basically, it's still a formal relationship. But he's basically saying, do to your father what he dished out. Now, again, if you think about what happened in Ahithophel's family, you can see where he's trying to get even with David here and humiliate David. But he doesn't just want to humiliate him, he wants to kill him. You know, so let's continue the story here. Verse 22, "And so they pitched a tent for Absalom on the top of the house, and Absalom went out to his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. And the counsel of Ahithophel, which was in those days, was as if one inquired of the oracle of God." In other words, it is like you've gotten wise advice from God himself. "So was all the counsel of Ahithophel with David and with Absalom. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, 'Now let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. And I will come upon him and when he is weary and weak and make him afraid. And all the people who are with him will flee, and I will strike only the king. and then I will bring back all the people to you, and I will return except the man whom you seek, and then all the people will be at peace. And the saying pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. So notice he literally wants to go kill David himself. You know, he's very ticked off at David. He wants to humiliate him, and now he wants to murder him. You know, well, Absalom accepts this. Well, God intervenes and basically warns David and what's going to happen, and the plan doesn't work. You know, but what's interesting is to see what happens with Ahithophel's life when his plan doesn't work out, you know, when things didn't work out the way he wanted to. Now, we'll skip down to 2 Samuel 17, verse 23. And we're kind of skipping to the end of the story here, but I just want you to see his reaction. Now, when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, arose, and went home to his house, to his city. And then he put his household in order and hanged himself and died, and he was buried in his father's tomb. Now notice, when his advice didn't work out, his plan to kill David didn't come to fruition, he kills himself. He destroys his own life. Why? Because he couldn't manage the anger. You know, his response to an injustice. Was the injustice real? Yes. David was guilty of all that he, you know, could accuse him of. Now, David had actually already repented before God, you know, and it's why God's protecting him here. But the lesson in this is Ahithophel destroys his own life, you know, and winds up, you know, literally killing himself, but because he can't manage his own emotions. It wasn't David's actions that destroyed him. It was his own inability to manage his own emotions that destroyed him. You know, one of the great lessons in all this is the lesson of forgiveness. You know, because oftentimes when people are very hurt by someone else over an injustice, and you talk about the subject of forgiveness, well, what you'll hear is, well, that dirty dog doesn't deserve to be forgiven. Why, let me tell you what they did to me. You know, and it's from the standpoint of whether or not they deserve it. If you understand forgiveness, forgiveness is not a gift you give to yourself. It is a gift you give, you know, I mean, a gift you give to the person who hurt you. It's a gift you give to yourself. Because who's making the payments on the debt? I mean, just think of it that way. Whose life is it affecting? Your own. You know, in Ahithophel's situation, if he'd been able to let it go and move on with his life, again, wouldn't change David's life. It would have saved his own life. You know, and that's one of the lessons we have to learn in this. Again, even if we've been truly done wrong, And we've suffered a great injustice. If we don't manage our own emotions well, we can destroy our own life. You know, and harboring that resentment and that anger, it's not hurting the other person. It's hurting ourselves. And it's giving an opportunity for Satan to manipulate us. You know, and again, there's lots of ways that this lesson can, you know, can play out of emotions throughout our lives. You know, there's lots of different triggers. It could be loneliness. It could be anger. It could be anxiety, you know, or jealousy. There's lots of emotions that can be played upon. And again, there's certainly not time in a sermon to cover all of them. You know, but it's one of the things that we need to be aware of is how our emotions can be played upon. To sit back and take a logical, analytical perspective of a subject and try to step away from the emotion and realize, okay, how does this, if I continue down this road, how is this movie going to end? You know, and one of the other things we need to realize in all this, it's not just about being logical or analytical about a situation. It's realizing that we have to have God's help to do this. You know, and sometimes when emotions are enveloping our lives, we just need to cry out to God. You know, just tell him, I need help right now. You know, this, you know, particular emotion situation is eating my lunch and really getting to me. And I really just need your help to get through this. And just, you know, cry out to him to get that spiritual help to get us through it. Because again, it's something that we all face and we all have these triggers. But again, as we look forward to the spring holy days and, you know, in planning ahead of that and examining our own lives, let's be aware that some of our, you know, the stumbling blocks that we all face oftentimes are triggered by our own emotions. And we need to be aware of that and realize that these triggers can happen and become stumbling blocks. And realize that Satan is an opportunist. You know, he's looking for that opportunity to get you wherever you're most vulnerable. And if he sees that vulnerability, he's going to seize upon that and play upon those emotions to try to lead us astray. So as we go forward, you know, towards the spring holy days here, let's be aware of this. And again, cry out to God for that help, for that insight to see those weaknesses in our own lives, and for the power of the Holy Spirit to be able to effectively manage our emotions.